frequency, 99.5. So it's 995.995.99. The password again, 995.995.99. In these unusual and difficult times, the Pacifica Network is struggling financially, so the LSB is working to have WBAI distinguish itself by doing everything necessary to be financially strong. That means increasing listenership, membership, and particularly listener contributions. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we sure hope you do. Please visit WBAI.org or call our pledge line at 212-209-2950 and donate to help strengthen WBAI. Thank you.
It's just something that's really been bugging me lately. I mean, it's not like I see it or anything. It's not like he's kneeling at the side of the bed, flogging himself with a leather switch, right? I wish, right? No.
Tune in on Saturday evening at 8 p.m. for WBAI Playhouse, a same-sex couple, a romantic yet tragic comedy drama.
I mean, all the other stuff I can sort of deal with, but the praying after sex, it makes everything sort of feel a little tainted somehow. I mean, how am I going to ever feel love? For real, you know, with all of that in the way.
It's a story of faith, commitment, and unconditional love. Jeffrey Knopf's next fall, Saturday, 8 p.m., June 4th,
okay,
right here on WBAI New York.
I know I'm sort of just dumping this all out there, but please, if you have any pearls, I would be glad for anything.
I'm Linda Perry, Program Director here at WBAI, inviting you to join me and General Station Manager Bertol Reimers for our Report to the Listener, Monday evening, June 6th, from 10 p.m. to midnight. That's WBAI's Station Manager and Program Director delivering our Report to the Listener and taking your calls at 212-209-2877. Please join us.
You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, with streaming at WBAI.org. Coming up next, on A Wing and a Prayer, Malika Lee Whitney with Untitled. And I know the theme is here someplace. I just know it. Please stand by. Yes, technical difficulties abound this evening at WBAI New York.
programmers and titles. So please have our listeners joining us this evening. One that is not without a few bumps and misses. But here we are. Tonight's broadcast, the focus is on film. And I'm very much looking forward to speaking to guests who have been patiently awaiting online. And they are named Tamara Lanier and David Rubin. Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Okay, I'm hearing two voices. There's been some technical snafus, but we are not going to be thwarted by them at all. I am really thrilled and excited to have both of you as guests on the program Untitled. And I'll repeat the names correctly this time, Tamara Lanier and David Rubin. And the point of this discussion has everything to do with a film entitled Free. I want to say that word one more time, Free Papa Renty. There's more to the title. So let me begin with you, David. I first want to know how the connection was made between yourself and Miss Lanier.
Wait. I'm hoping that Tammy is on the phone with me. Tammy?
Yes. Yes, I am here.
Ah, good, good. So, the film is called Free Renty, Lanier versus Harvard. And it is about the lawsuit that Tammy Lanier brought, must be 4 years ago now, against Harvard. And I followed her determination to win that lawsuit over the course of 3 years. And we're still waiting for the final verdict. And I got connected to this story because my cousin, Mike Koskoff, was one of the lawyers. And he said, this is a case that's going to interest you, David. And wait till you meet Tammy Lanier, you'll even get more interested. And when he told me about the case, and then I met Tammy, I said, this is a case with important implications. And if Tammy is determined as I think she is, I want to be a part of it. I want to film it.
Well, I want to meet Tammy, if I may say as well, by starting out asking or really having you confirm the fact that life, ancestry, and legacy hold great significance for you. And so much of what David said just lines up, of course, to the valiant efforts that you're making to claim, reclaim, seek restitution and reparations. So for our audience, just share what that history means to you and your family and, of course, Papa Wentz.
Well, good evening. My name is Tamara Lanier, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my journey and my story with your audience this evening. And I guess it's probably best to start with my mother, who I refer to as the keeper of our family story, the keeper of our oral history. My mother was born in a small community called Mount Meigs, Montgomery, Alabama. And she grew up, she would often talk about growing up in the Jim Crow South. And ultimately, she migrated north and moved to a small community of North Connecticut. But my mother, she may have left the South, but the South was always a part of who she was. But not only that, the oral history and the legacy and the rich family history and family stories that my mother heard from her elders was something that was a part of who she was, and she made it a point to make sure that we, her children and her grandchildren, and her nieces and nephews and anyone who would listen, knew who we were and where we came from. And my mother would always start, when she would talk about our oral history, she would start with the proud Black African, Papa Renty, and who he was. She would talk about him being a literate person, that under the most impossibilities that he learned to read, that he not only learned to read, that he would teach others to read. My mother was very proud of that, and she was very proud of the man that she had heard so much about, Papa Rinty, the fact that he was a religious person, that he taught the Bible, that he read the Bible to people. And there were many stories about who this man was. And when my mom would sit down with us, when we would have our quiet times, when we would sit down on Sunday evenings, my mom would talk about our ancestry. But she would start with that proud Black African, Papa Rinty. And as my mom grew older, she developed some health issues that later took her life. But as my mom started to recognize her own mortality and that time was short for her, one of the things that she would say to me regularly is, I want you to write this down. Write this down. Remember these things. Always remember, she would say, that we're Taylors and not Thompsons. Always remember you're African and you're Indian. And she would just make sure, I mean, this was like a mantra for her. She would say this to me. She would say this to my children. And when my mom passed, I set out to keep my promise to her to document our family history. And in doing so, I unearthed this amazing story of Papa Rinty, who he was, what happened to him, and how he ended up as a relic in Harvard's Peabody Museum. And
Miss Lanier, if I may, just to yes. add to the frame of how you are digging so purposely deep into the family history aspect, however, with the bastion of so-called higher education, Harvard University, you've also had other voices in support of your efforts for the reclamation and restitution that I made mention of earlier, and that is has to do with a particular image or images. So can you briefly just frame that, and then I'd like to bring David back into the conversation.
Okay. And so that I understand, you want me to talk about the images and how Harvard holding the images and the nature of our complaint, so to speak, or the struggle
yes,
over who has
very,
the right.
Very,
okay.
Very, yes, very specifically.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. So in doing the research, what I learned is that there is currently images of my enslaved ancestors held by the Harvard University's Peabody Museum. And in learning that, I reached out to the university and I said, I have an amazing story to tell about who these enslaved people were. I know their legacy. I know their history. I am a descendant of these enslaved people. And Harvard was dismissive. They weren't interested in my story. They had set already a narrative as to who these enslaved people were, and they were moving forward with that and not really acknowledging their rich legacy. And so after years of trying to convince Harvard to look at the research showing that I'm a lineal descendant, and asking them to tell the story of who these people were and what their rich history was, as opposed to the narrative that they had already created in terms of Louis Agassiz's story. Louis Agassiz was the scientist who used my enslaved ancestors, in addition to other enslaved people, to promote a theory of white supremacy using images, daguerreotypes, of these enslaved people. Louis Agassiz sought to create what is referred to as ocular proof of the inferiority of Black people. And he was doing this at a time when the country was divided over the question of slavery or emancipation. So it was propaganda to promote slavery. This is what was going on at Harvard at the time. And this was the story that Harvard was telling about Louis Agassiz, and continuing with the narrative that these people are invisible, We don't know who they are. And just, you know, allowing that false propaganda of Louis Agassiz to stand. So I think you're pressuring Harvard.
Ms. Lanier, may I ask you just to hold that point? Because I have to give a station ID. You're tuned to listener sponsor, WBAI Radio. The program is untitled, and guests on the line include David Grubin, who is the director of the documentary film that we're discussing with Tamara Lanier. David, I would ask if you would return to the line and express your thoughts on the fact that bringing charges or a case such as this into documentary format is something that's current, it's something that's relative, it's something that many people will feel a connection to. You stated earlier how you came to know Ms. Lanier, but certainly for you, having this kind of information available to create a work that has legacy connected to it, how connected do you feel to the work and to the struggle that's likely ahead to try and get a turnaround in the decisions that are being made about co-optation, shall we call it?
Yes, well, that's a good question. Let me say that if you were to see this daguerreotype, which was taken, as Tammy tells us, to prove that Africans are inferior. It was taken for that reason. Obviously, Tammy's great-great-great-grandfather didn't consent to that picture. You can see it in his face. It's a very powerful image of a defiant human being. And when you see that, you realize that this man was standing up for himself. He was doing everything he could to preserve his dignity, and that's what Tammy is doing today. She's saying he had a name, he had a history, he was a person, and we can all identify with that because we all come from ancestors. And I can just imagine if I saw my great 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 grandfather depicted like that, if I knew that he was stripped naked to take the picture. I'd feel the same way. I'd be horrified, and I also would be going up against. So Tammy's going up against the oldest, the wealthiest, probably the most prestigious university in America, and trying to get them to give her family icon. In the beginning, she just wanted to help them, give them information. Now, she's going all the way. And anyone can identify with her struggle and her determination for justice.
Well, absolutely. I have to add to those thoughts that it's necessary to take the path that she's taking. And I think it's very important for me to mention the fact that the film, the documentary rather, is actually being shown as part of the Brooklyn Film Festival. It's in its 25th year. Marco Lucino is the executive director, and I certainly urge our listeners to put this on their list of things to see because it's a very, very relevant and important aspect of history that should not be cast about or contained where it does not belong. Missed a few moments. As I mentioned early on, because of some technical issues, I do want to add that Ms. Grubin has some very distinguished credentials working in the area of professional film, with credits as a writer, producer, cinematographer, numerous awards and accomplishments recognized, DuPont, Peabody, Emmy, Writers Guild, all of that. I think the pairing of both of you makes for a win. And if folks want to find out more and especially to be able to view the screening of Free Renzi, it's a historic piece. It's very important to us. And I will have to leave it there, but I certainly am going to seek a broader program time slot so that this discussion can go on further. I do understand that there are some other, you are all marquee folks for what you're doing, but there's some other voices that have come on to this project to support your efforts. So I want to thank you so much, Ms. Lanier, and to you, David Zubin. And I also want to recognize Lisa King for her exceptional support in helping me to make the connection with you both. So we're moving forward, but do expect another outreach effort on my behalf, because this is a topic that really requires much more time. And congratulations to the work and to your intrepid efforts, you know, to keep at it. So this is listener-sponsored WBAI Radio, streaming at WBAI.org worldwide. So hopefully eyes are awake and staying woke and listening to this very important work. So, again, thank you both. Hopefully hear from you again real soon. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Wow. You have sometimes you have to go up against the prestige, the moneyed, the recognized, you know, when it comes to saving our legacy. So we may have a little clip coming up to precede our next guest, and I certainly hope that we'll be hearing from Karen McMullen, who will share highlights from the upcoming Tribeca Film Festival. And actually, the Brooklyn Film Festival opens tonight. So stay tuned. Listener-sponsored WBAI. Non-commercial WBAI. And we exist with your support. And we want to do more than exist. We want to thrive as a radio station where voices can be heard. Max?
Which clip would you like?
The shorty.
For Renty?
And then we'll put Karen on the line. More than it's here. We want to
Years ago, when I made my business card, I put Black Lives Matter over the chest of my Papa Renty. He symbolizes the meaning behind the statement, Black Lives Matter. He is the original disinherited person. From George Floyd and a knee on the neck for 9 minutes. From slavery to where we are today, there is a long progression of disinheritance of Black people. For any healing, we have to go back to the history of how we got to where we are. And I say, let's start with my Papa Renty.
Memory is a selection of images.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. Are you just
I jumped the gun with the next clip.
Oh,
you want it?
Karen, let me start with Karen, and then we'll go into East Bayou once we lay out what
we're
going to
talk about.
Which
one are you talking about, Malika?
He has a clip of Eve's Bayou.
Bayou, uh-huh. Uh-huh, okay.
Uh-huh. So, I guess we're on, okay, because I hear your voice. We had some techie issues at the top. Verizon has some shutdown of lines, and, oh, it was a fixing and a mess. But here we are. So thank you so much for joining us here on WBAI once again, Karen McMullen. And I should say a couple of things about you. Good things, only good things. Your faith in the place and actively engaged for so many years as a programmer. You have background as a film editor, and you've worked with some amazing film representing entities, including Tide, New Voices in Black Cinema, Doc NYC, and, of course, here this evening to share with us highlights from the Tribeca Film Festival. So you want to mention a few, and then I'll cue Max to drop in some of Eve's bio.
Sure. Hi, and thank you, Sister Malika. It's great to be back on. Tribeca is presenting a really great slate of Black-directed films, as well as TV and podcasts and immersive. I'm going to talk to you here about some of the feature films and some shorts. We have a whole Juneteenth program that goes throughout the whole festival, but it culminates on the last day. Films that have played throughout the festival culminate on June 18th for an encore screening. Some of my favorite presentations are the Juneteenth Shorts Program, and that's a collection of six short films by Black filmmakers. They're all documentaries, and they celebrate Black arts and artists. There's some really dynamic pieces there. There's a sculptress who celebrates Huey Newton. There's a woman documents Kehinde Wiley and Amy Sherald, who did the Obama portraits. There's Black ballerinas. It's really a wonderful tribute to Black creativity. Other films we have a lot of docs playing. We have Hazing by Byron Short, by Byron Hurt. We have Aisha, which is a film starring Letitia Wright, as she plays an immigrant in Ireland seeking asylum. We have Andrew Dismo's new narrative feature film called Beauty, and which is a fictionalized account of a Whitney Houston-esque singer and her trials trying to make it as a famous person, against overprotective parents and navigating her young love. So there's really something for everyone. Historical docs. We have a documentary about Rosa Parks. We have documentaries about voter rights and Selma. We really just run the gamut.
It really sounds like a wonderfully curated slate. Do you see, particularly at this time of year, we know why it's important to show the tremendous creative diversity among makers, and it does appear that film festivals going forward are actually broadening, the scope of some of the things that are being shown. For you, being at the helm of watching all of these films, do you notice a particular through line in terms of the content of the films and how you anticipate that viewers will respond?
I really don't notice a particular trend. We're coming out of, the pandemic, and if you can imagine trying to make a film during such a time, film is such a collaborative art, and so film sets are so people intensive. So we did find that we skewed heavily towards narrative films, documentary films, which don't necessarily need as many people on set. You can have a interview just with a few people, a talking head interview, and you can use a lot of archival and stock footage to fill in, versus a narrative film that involves recreating a whole world that you have to go out on a set and shoot. Those we didn't have that many of this year. So before I would claim to any kind of trend in the industry, I really have to recognize that, the pandemic threw a wrench in film production, and I really commend the filmmakers for getting things done under such circumstances.
You happen to mention favorites of mine have always been short, and certainly being what you just described, it gives a little more wiggle room for makers. They have to work, I would think, twice and three times as hard to have a specific focus and content in their work in a short period of time. But it gives them an opportunity to make their statements and make those statements well received. What is it about shorts that you most enjoy?
I'm just amazed that people can convey entire stories in like 14 minutes. You know,
yes.
You can really, I've been really moved by shorts. They're hard to see outside of festivals. Traditionally, it was really difficult to see them. Now with Vimeo and YouTube and Amazon Prime, actually, they're all streaming shorts, which is lovely. So they do have a larger life beyond festivals. But it's a wonderful calling card also for filmmakers. You know, you start off with a film. We have a film in the festival called Our Father the Devil by a really dynamic woman filmmaker named Ellie Foonby. And I saw a short of hers at Black Star a few years ago, and I programmed it at the Tide Film Festival years later, and here she is with a feature film. That's fantastic. So it's a very nice training ground for filmmakers to kind of work out some of the kinks of their work and get noticed and hopefully go on to make feature films.
On the Slate is... I think something that I would call a classic. I'd never imagined I'd be making a statement that Eve Bayou 25 years ago and mm-hmm. the special event that's going to be happening around that. Would you address and talk about that a bit? And then I'll ask Max to play the short clip that we have.
Sure. Eve Bayou is having its 25th anniversary. I, like you, can't believe that it was 1997 where this film came out. Where did the time go?
Yes.
It was
right.
directed by Casey Lemons, one of the few mm-hmm. black film female filmmakers to get such notoriety, one of the earliest also. And she will be at the festival with the film, which will be fantastic. She'll be joined with cast members Jurnee Smollett, who's a child at the time, Lynn Whitfield, and Megan Good. The film also stars Sam Jackson and Debbie Morgan and a whole Diane Carroll cast of really wonderful black actors who won't be at the festival, but who we all love and feel represent us and our stories in a beautiful way.
The 25. I just have to say 25. It again. It's like hard
yeah.
to believe.
Yeah.
So,
and it was her directorial debut also when she made it. That was her
nice.
First. Yeah.
Right. It was lovely. A lovely film. I enjoyed it so much. Max, can we run the jewel of Eve Bayou?
Memory is a selection of images, some elusive, others printed indelibly on the brain.
Daddy loves you so much.
I know.
We'll dance at every party.
Each image is like a thread. Each thread woven together to make a tapestry of intricate texture.
When I first met Lewis, I said to myself, he's a healer, he'll take care of me.
Do you still love her?
Men fought each other for the privilege of speaking her name.
And the tapestry tells a story.
And I find out he's just a man.
You're in trouble. They're really mad.
Who, them? They always mad.
And the story is our past.
I'll never forgive you if you drive him away.
I'm not your damn patient.
The summer I killed my father, I was 10 years old.
I saw Daddy.
What?
Daddy and Mrs. Moreau.
That's a lie.
What's wrong with her?
Oh, she'll be all right.
Have you told anyone? Because if you tell, I swear I'll do you all.
You know, I love my sister, but she's not unfamiliar with the inside of a mental hospital.
Sunday, which one of your patients you gonna see, Lewis?
What is wrong with that lady?
Some illness hard to put a finger on.
Not every night he's not working. I know he's not.
She thinks I'm driving you away.
She's a child, Rob.
How do you kill someone with Rudy?
Put his hair inside the wax coffin. Buried it in the graveyard.
That's ridiculous.
You want to face the dead?
But you can't kill people with voodoo.
Sometimes a soldier falls on his own sword.
Yes. You speak to my wife or dad, and I will kill you.
God.
Batgirl.
I hate him.
Scooter on the tag of
I must say. Great casting. Agree, mm-hmm. Karen? Great.
Yeah,
casting.
Absolutely.
What an really, ensemble.
Really fantastic.
Going through that. Yeah.
And do you in 2018, it was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry. So that is wonderful to have it recognized on that level.
Certainly. And everyone in it, you know, they have that bright lights of stardom shining on them, you know, and continuously doing so. I'm looking at my notes, and I wanted to, you mentioned Byron's film, Hazing, and it's one of the pieces that can be seen online. Am I correct?
Correct. Hazing is a feature documentary, and it's one of our Tribeca at Home selections. It's for our Tribeca online premieres. So, and that handles the subject, the very difficult subject of hazing, not only on college campuses with Greek letter organizations, but also in the military. It takes place in some of the bands in the southern schools, law enforcement, and he really tackles he himself is a member of a Greek organization, so he is interrogating his own involvement in it, whether there was value in going through that terrifying process. And he also talks to a lot of parents who've lost children to hazing accidents. Hazing's gone terribly wrong, and parents who now have dead children who were attempting to join these organizations. It's very engaging. It's not judgmental, and he, you know, is not pointing fingers, but he does pull back the veil of secrecy a bit and lets people see inside the mentality of the big brothers and those who want to join those organizations.
Yeah, that kind of activity is association with status, but also it puts you through some rigors that, as you mentioned, and as I'm sure the film covers, things that don't turn out well for those who are pledging, you know, to be part of. And if you're just joining us, you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI. I'm Malika Lee Whitney. The program is on title. And this evening's broadcast, the focus is on film. We talked earlier with makers and subjects as part of the Brooklyn Film Festival. We're not partial, so we like to give everybody some time to shine. And, of course, the Tribeca actually moved from its earlier spring date into June and has made, you know, quite a number of adjustments to bring a full lineup of some very interesting offerings. Karen McMullen is on the line. And before we close out, is there anything that has not been mentioned that you wanted to share a bit more on before we close?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that in addition to the films, we have some really dynamic panels this year. They are free if you go online. Most of them are free. They are co-hosted by Black House, which some film aficionados know is a Black organization that has presence at the major film festivals. There's a panel with Ben Crump and Rashad Robinson from Color of Change on a documentary that's in the festival called Civil, which follows a year in the life of Ben Crump, the civil rights attorney. There's a wonderful panel on the representation of Black people on screen by a collection of Pulitzer Prize-winning Black journalists, including Jelani Cobb, Wesley Morris, Robin Givon, and that's, you know, not to be missed. We have a discussion on reparations and on the civil rights, you know, documenting civil rights on screen. And we have two pairs of filmmakers there. We have the filmmaker team behind the Rosa Parks documentary. That's Yorba Richin and Joanna Hamilton. And also the film on reparations called The Big Payback, one of my favorite films names in the festival. I think that's a great title for reparations film, The Big Payback. And that's directed by a filmmaking team, Whitney Dow and Erica Alexander, who we know as Maxine from Living Single Day. She's gotten into the director's chair.
And how many years ago was that, you know?
How many years ago
was
that?
Right?
Yeah, little Maxine has grown up.
Yes. It's great to be able to be around, you know, for these time markers for the work. I want to thank you so much for always being accessible in the midst of all that you're doing. And I certainly hope to see you at something during the course of the run of Tribeca. So you're appreciated.
Thank you very much. And I encourage your viewers to, your listeners to go onto the site and check out. There's many free things to take advantage of. There's some outdoor screenings with Sidney Poitier retrospective. You know, Raisin in the Sun is showing, Stir Crazy. There's some really great fairs. Ticketed and, you know, free and paid, but lots to take advantage of. Thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure all mine. Do take care. And we're going to pause here. We have another guest coming up and being representing a very, very exciting, I like to call it like champagne and bubbles, effervescent, Emily Branham, director of Being Bebe, will be with us. Max, is that clip available?
I'm sorry, I was busy answering the phone. Which clip?
Being Bebe. Has Emily tuned in?
Yes, I believe she is here, and we have the clip.
Okay, let's do the clip first, and then we'll begin our conversation.
I'm just a male who can perform the duties which are generally allocated for the female sex.
Zahara Benet is with us, and you know she won the first RuPaul's Drag Race.
It was just God's gift to the world.
God's gift to us first, then the world.
Yeah.
I traveled many, many miles away from my family and friends to pursue a dream, and I will not stop until I've reached the end of my journey.
Isn't it so interesting, like, how beautiful I looked back then, and then now even, like, way more beautiful? No, I'm joking.
Emily?
Yes, hello.
You heard me say bubbly. You heard me say effervescent. How else can I describe? And I have to make it sound big and bubbly. I'm so happy that you've joined us. And certainly the spirit of the star will be present, and we will definitely keep them where they belong, in the stratosphere of good things. So thank you so much for joining us here on WBAI.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to speak with you.
So, first-time documentary.
My first feature.
So we'll get those out the way. First-time doc, was that your choice of, because there are many forms in which visual media can be shown, you know, narratives, experimental, feature,
yeah.
And you chose doc. Why?
Yeah, so when I went to film school, I feel like, you know, my first love that I found there was music videos. I just felt like there was unlimited potential in combining music and images and dance and light. And yeah, it could go experimental, it could go narrative, and like at the heart of it would be music. Like I've always just been such a fan of music, and it's been so important to my life. And so... But when I first met Bebe and stumbled upon her story, my little sister was dancing backup for Bebe in Minneapolis, where we grew up, for a local pageant. And I was in New York working on music videos and commercials. And as soon as she mentioned Bebe and told me a little bit about her, that she was originally from Cameroon, that she was like this promising amateur on the Minneapolis scene coming up and on her way to her first national pageant, I was like, wow. Like, it just hit me kind of immediately. Like, that sounds like an amazing short film. Like, I feel like that wants to be a documentary. And then I went out and saw Bibi perform live and was completely blown away and was like, oh, yes, this is a person that has something very special going on. And unfortunately, Bibi was on board with having me come to Dallas for the first national pageant. And, you know, there was just a lot more there, the more we got to know each other. And fortunately, she was open to me following her around a little bit longer. And, you know, 3 years after that, she was cast on the very first season of this new reality show, RuPaul's Drag Race, and she won. And that was in 2009. And I thought, oh, great, the movie's done. That's a great ending. And as soon as we got in the editing room, I realized, oh, wait, no, it's more of an inciting incident, actually. And, yeah, fortunately, Bibi was open to letting me follow around a little longer and seeing what we could make together.
Well, you've made the paths and the footprints and schlepping around all the equipment that has to be gathered to make it happen. When you hear a story, of course, of the life of Bibi Zahara Bennett, you know there's much more to it. Coming from West Africa and perhaps, or I shouldn't say perhaps, but the something that one can depend on is non-acceptance when you choose a particular way that you choose to live and love. And how were you comfortable dealing with those emotive issues that would come up when a story that's in the documentary framework being told?
Yeah, I mean, you're completely right. And that was one of the first things that I learned when I researched a little bit about Cameroon was that it was not a hospitable place for same-sex intimacy or even for violating gender norms at all, like you do in drag. You know, from the very beginning, Bibi was really consistent in separating drag from sexuality and separating the career from his identity in terms of gender identity, sexual orientation. He really kept that separate, and he was also really consistent in just refusing to put any kind of labels on his gender identity or sexual orientation. And, you know, this was his career. This was his passion. This was his purpose that he was really, really good at and making a good living doing. And he just felt, you know, he was doing what an African firstborn male is supposed to do when, you know, his parents sent him to the U.S. He was just doing it in a slightly unconventional way, but he was making a living. He was supporting his siblings. He was sending money back home. Like, he was doing what he needed to do. He just, you know, he didn't follow the conventional path that they all expected, especially being a really academic family themselves. So it was, you know, it was really interesting to navigate. And I feel like from the very beginning, Bibi surprised me and didn't always give back what I was expecting in a lot of ways, which just made me want to understand more why Bibi is the way Bibi is. And, you know, it took 15 years to get to the heart of that, and I feel like we come at it in a variety of different ways, and it's a more deep portrait because of that.
What would you say enabled you to continue pressing on and also jumping into the now where one would think that the times that we're living in would enable folks to have a broader view of those who choose and make the choices that they do, but yet there are signs all around us that non-acceptance that I mentioned earlier is still ever present. And were there times when you were having to work through that, you know, in terms of following the career of Bibi?
Yeah, I think what was interesting and hard to sort of get at was where Bibi was at with it, you know? Like, Bibi was a person who always put on an incredibly brave, strong, upbeat face at every step. And he was an incredibly accomplished, capable, self-confident human being at every step of his career, even in the sort of, like, fallow period that we follow in, like, 2014, 2015, when he was in New York and, you know, really kind of stuck in his career. There were like 100 Drag Race girls that had now been on the show who were all competing for the same gigs. And, And, you know, she was sort of, her 15 minutes were starting to evaporate, and she was, you know, probably at her lowest point. Even then, the amount of sort of strength and self-confidence and almost this, like, impenetrable shell of confidence was an interesting challenge as a documentary filmmaker to try to grapple with, because, you know, on the one hand, I knew from filming with him for so long and being, you know, good friends with him at this point, that that was one of his coping mechanisms that he developed in childhood, was wherever he went, he made himself the star, as he says in the documentary, like even growing up as a child, and because he felt that being the star protects you. And so anytime he was made to feel different, he had a way of sort of like using his charisma to make everybody fall in love with him and support him more. So it was really interesting because Bebe really deflects negativity and any kind of, you know, challenge that the way he's living, the way he's making his way in the world with his career is anything but the right thing to do and the thing that everybody else should get on board with and celebrate. It's pretty incredible, right. Honestly. It's really empowering to watch.
To affirm some of that, there have been numerous awards and other forms of recognition bestowed and referencing the work. So that is certainly a way that the creativity speaks for itself, you know, when the accolades pour in. So are there a few in particular that you're real proud of? I did note that the documentary did screen in 2021 at Tribeca, and it will have accessibility as part of Fuse, a premiere coming up on the 7th and June 21st, and also connections to Out TV and other streaming platforms. So the awards and the accolades, what did that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, we have been so fortunate to have won a few awards on our festival tour. We premiered at Tribeca, like you said, about a year ago, coming up on our year anniversary with the festival kicking off here again soon. Bebe's actually performing at this year's Tribeca as well on the 15th. And that's just such a beautiful thing to be doing all at once, is celebrating the rollout of our film on iTunes on the 7th, which you can pre-order now. And then, you know, our broadcast premiere in the U.S. on the 21st, like you said, on Fuse. And then internationally, with partners like Out TV in Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. But in terms of awards, honestly, the highest honors I feel like we could have received were given to us in our hometown of Minneapolis this past fall. We were closing night of the Sound Unseen Music and Film Festival. And that's just a wonderful festival. And we won Best Documentary there and got to play to a sold-out house at the Walker Art Center, which is, you know, a wonderful art museum that I grew up going to. And we were, you know, it was a sold-out house full of Bebe's extended family and drag family. And, you know, everyone I've known since I was a kid, too, kind of came and supported us. And so to win there in that room. And the same night, the mayor of Minneapolis named that day Bebe Zaharabaneh Day for the city of Minneapolis.
What?
Bebe got an award. The film got an award. This is a wonderful, magical day.
Well, that definitely means that you're awarded as well. I want to thank you so much, and so glad to hear that Bebe will be doing her thing in New York as well. And I really have to give a special thanks to Brian Gelden.
We love Brian Gelden.
Always being so supportive. So definitely keep my eyes peeled, and thank you so much and congratulations. And we're going to close a video entitled Awaken Dawn by 11 Films. It has everything to do with the missteps that are happening right now. So, Max, if you can pull that up, titled This Video Will Change You. And has a couple of bleeps in it, but it's a great message. So thank you all so much. Thank you for bearing with a few snafus. One of those utilities caused a few of the missteps. I'm Malika Lee Whitney for Untitled. Max, you ready?
I'm done, okay? I'm done. I've had it. They f***ed our kids again. You know, how many more times?
I'd hoped when I became president, I would not have to do this again. To lose a child is like having a piece of your soul ripped away.
Every time I think about those kids, once again, it gets me mad.
There's a hollowness in your chest. You feel like you're being sucked into it. It's
all. How am I going to plan a funeral? What kind of casket? I have to write a eulogy. All I did was send that to school. This time.
90% of us are living under the tyranny of 10%.
Sit down. You're out of line.
They seem angrier at Beto O'Rourke than they were at the massacre of 19 children and 2 fourth grade teachers.
And I'm trying to figure out at what point in time this became so normalized.
The AR-15 shreds the human body. Just think about that. Think about what that would do to a little 10-year-old body.
What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
And you read their age. 10.
I have a fourth grader, and she put her hands in her friend's blood and then smeared it, she said, all over her body. She wanted to look like she was dead.
What are we doing?
And we were all hiding behind a stage.
What are we doing?
He said bro. Red flag.
Why only in America? It is just an American problem, sir.
America needs us to scream for them right now!
When are we gonna do something?
Yeah, I was bullied in school too. I never shot up my classmates. Next excuse.
So honestly, to hell with anybody who says don't politicize this. This is about semi-automatic weapons and military weapons that are killing our children in school.
This mama will not take the stage, but I will be in conversation with Harlem Stage. Hello, everyone. This is Mama Soul. Myself and the Law will have a wonderful guest this Friday on the Harlem Connection to Harlem Stage. The one and only Pat Cruz, Artistic Director and CEO of Harlem Stage. And we're talking all things about the wonderful venue, as well as we may have a special guest. So join us this Friday, 10 p.m. right here on WBAI, the Harlem Connection to Harlem Stage. Let's.
The value of this radio station in a time like this cannot be overstated. Our progressive programming, covering arts and culture, public affairs, social and political issues, means so much to many. And that includes you, right? Support WBAI to ensure our impact and continue.